All right. Well, of course, this is the place where I say turn with me, if you will, to the place where this week's Torah portion begins, which is the book of Bereshit, or Genesis, chapter 23, starts in the first verse. And the Hebrew words, of course, are Yehin, I believe that's how that would be, Chaye Sarah. So it's Chaye Sarah that the Torah portion is named for, and literally that means the life of Sarah. And what it says is, translated into English, and the life of Sarah was, and it's an interesting way to put this, it doesn't say 127 years. What it literally says is 107 and 20 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And there's some interesting teaching on that. I won't belabor this, but for those that have looked at the idea of gematria, the reason why it may be broken down that way is suggested is because those three numbers are all associated with something, perhaps phases in her life, but also the number 100 is generally associated with wisdom, number 20, beauty and strength, and as we've read from some of the things already, certainly Sarah kept those attributes literally through her whole life, and number 7 is associated with a number of things in Scripture. Among, in this case, they reference innocence, but also, of course, 7 is a number of completion. And the reference to innocence may refer to the fact that, well, perhaps we're talking about the first 7 years of Sarah's life with that distinction. But in any case, verse 2 tells us, "And then Sarah died in Kiriat Arba, place called Hebron, in the land of Canaan, and Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her." And what we're going to see after this, this is where I pause and say, this Torah portion is, as I like to put it, the literally most complete and filled up with meaning, let's call it a common law textbook parsha in the Torah. Now, there's a lot of the Torah that has to do with elements that are now described, or at least back when we had a rule of law, they would have been called the English common law. And it was clearly understood that they had a huge basis in Torah. And a lot of what we see in the common law is not just, you know, shalls and shalt nots, you know, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal, things that are done routinely nowadays by Big Brother's nation and worldwide. Now, these were things that are also described by actions, and that's what this portion is about. We're going to see a number of things in here that are literally elements of the common law, in particular, the first one, contract law, that are described not with, here's how you do it, but with an example. And in this case, it's the example of Abraham. So as we go through this, I'll at least outline some of them. You're going to see all 5 of the elements of contract law that have been taught for centuries as, you know, the way contracts are done that are all demonstrated right here. And then we're going to see something similar with what would be called agency or a representation or what it means to come in the name of. So here we go. Abraham rose up from before his dead, and he spoke unto the children of Heth, and he said the following, "I'm a stranger and a sojourner with you, so give me a possession of a burying place with you, that I might bury my dead out of my sight." And the children of Heth answered Abraham, and they said to him the following, "Hear us, my lord, you're a mighty prince among us. In the choicest of our sepulchres you may bury your dead. None of us would hold from you his sepulchre, but with that meaning, you know, so that you could bury your dead." Well, that sounds nice, right? So Abraham rose up, and he bowed down to the people of the land, to the children of Heth. And then he spoke with them, and he said the following, "If it be in your mind that I should bury my dead out of my sight, hear me, and entreat for me to Ephron, son of Zohar, that he might give me," that's not the word that he's actually going to end up with, "give me the cave of Machpelah," which he has. That doesn't mean donate to me, although that's how it's going to at least start out here. "The cave of Machpelah that he has in the face and the end of his field." Now that word Machpelah literally has the meaning of double. So he wants this cave, and it says here he intends to pay the full price. "Let him give it to me for the full price in the midst of you for a possession of a burying place." Well, Ephron was there, sitting in the midst of the children of Heth, and he answered in the hearing of all the children of Heth, oh, let's pause, even all that went in at the gate of his city. So, what are we seeing here? One of the first principles. This is going to be done publicly. It's going to be done before witnesses. And we're going to see the elements, literally, described before witnesses so that the offer and the acceptance that are going to take place here are also witnessed. And even as it turns out, they're going to be recorded. So Ephron says the following, "Nay, my lord, hear me. The field, I'll just give it to you. Yeah, for a freebie. The cave that's therein, I'll give it to you. In the presence of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead." Well, Abraham bowed down before the people of the land, and he spoke to Ephron within the hearing of the people. We're going to see that reference again and again, of course. And he said the following, "But if you will, I pray you hear me. I'll give you the price of the field. Take it of me. I'll bury my dead there." Now, here I'm going to pause, okay, because you always want to know why, and we're not told explicitly why, but I think we have plenty of information at this point to understand why. Yes, there may be a lack of trust issue. Yes, there's certainly an issue of what happens 50, 100, 1,000 years from now. And yes, arguably even more importantly, whether Abraham understood it or not, I do kind of think he had a glimpse or an understanding of it. This event, this transaction is going to be memorialized in the Torah for all time as an example. So it's important that it be done right. And it's also going to be recorded. And of course, that makes all the difference because generations later, even millennia later, this document, the Torah itself, and the witnesses all stand as an indication of, yep, it was done. And whoever the children of Heth might have been, that doesn't matter. What matters is it was recorded, and Abraham and his descendants have this place in the land forever. And arguably, this is the first recorded deed, land deed, in human history. So Ephron then listens to him, and he says the following, "My lord, hearken to me. A price, a piece of that land. Whoa, it's some really expensive land, dude. This is worth 400 shekels of silver, kasef. What's that between me and you? Ah, bury your dead." Abraham hearkened unto Ephron, and Ephron weighed to Ephron, and Abraham weighed to Ephron the kasef, the silver. Now you notice, he's named a price. In the hearing of witnesses, he named a price. Abraham's already said he'll pay the price, and indeed he does. So within the sight of and hearing of the children of Heth, he weighed out the shekels of silver. And we'll come back to that in a second, but I want to make one more interesting point. I've already mentioned gematria a little bit. I'm not super big on gematria, but there are some interesting elements to this that kind of lend some weight to the discussion. For one, throughout the Bible, we see that the name Ephron is generally spelled with a vav. Usually has a vav in it. But in this case, this one case, it doesn't have the vav. Why would they spell it, well, wrong in this verse? It would seem the answer is, if you look at the gematria of Ephron as it's spelled, it turns out that they've made it equal to 400, which is the weight of the kasef. That's also part of the contract price. I always thought that was kind of cool. In any case, so Abraham hearkened to Ephron without the vav. He weighed to Ephron the silver, which he'd named in the hearing of the children of Heth. See, it's pointing this out. He has agreed to the price, and he is consummating the deal within the hearing and in front of the children of Heth. 400 shekels of silver, and then it tells us current money of the merchant, of trade. Coin of the realm, if you want to put it that way. And note again, real money is silver. The actual word here, kasef, is just used over and again. And the English sometimes chooses to translate it as silver, sometimes chooses to translate it as money. I guess for consistency's sake, it should always be silver because that's what it is. It's just that people nowadays don't even recognize that, well, silver is money, period. So it says, "The field of Ephron, which was in Machpelah, which was before Mamre, the field, the cave, everything within it, and all the trees in the field that were in all the border thereof round about, were made sure." unto Abram, now Abraham, for a possession in the presence of the children of Heth before all that went in at the gate of the city. So the gate of the city is another one of these legal-sounding references. The elders would sit in the city gates, and that is where the business was conducted on behalf of the people there. So all of this basically is outlining literally every element: offer and acceptance, compensation, and witnesses. And yes, it's a lawful contract too. So there are the five elements of contract law, all right here, nicely, neatly put forward in this one story. And now we have a land deed, the first one in history recorded for all time, and there can be no doubt that Abraham bought for and paid. Even if it was an exorbitant price, he didn't argue. The field is his, made sure, literally, in the surest of ways. After that, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre in Hebron in the land of Canaan. And the field and the cave that's therein were made sure unto Abraham for a possession of a burying place by the children of Heth. Now, there's another interesting aspect of this story I've always thought was kind of poignant, and that is here in death, and the tragedy of the death of Sarah, literally a companion that most of us can't even quite relate to. He has known this woman, think about it, she's been his wife for well over a century. And we think a golden anniversary is a big deal. Most people don't live long enough to even come close to that, sadly, nowadays. But there's this one other element, too, and that is that out of that comes the fact that now, for the first time in his life, Abraham has seen a sure possession, a transfer, a deed to at least a bit of the promised land in his lifetime. Now, he's walked the land and been told that this is the land that will, in fact, be given to his descendants. But now he's seen a part of it. Chapter 24 says, well, Abraham was old, well stricken in age, and Yahuwah had blessed him, v'kol. Bekol, actually, with all, in everything. Literally, it just means with all, in all. And Abraham then says to his servant. Now, we think we know what his servant's name is. It's Eliezer everywhere else. But in this particular story, the entire section here, his name is not mentioned once. And I've always contended that is absolutely key. Scripture doesn't miss a beat. The point is, he's not Eliezer in this story. He is the servant. And are we going to see, yep, that he's a good and faithful servant, that he faithfully executes the task that's given to him, that he does, in fact, go in his master's name as his agent, his representative, with power of attorney, to do all of the things which Abraham could, in fact, himself do. So if you want to look at this as kind of common law section 2, that's exactly what we're seeing. We're seeing a description of delegation of authority, power of attorney, agency, and also, of course, what it means to be a good and faithful servant and to come in the name of the master, which is why he isn't called by his name. He's just the servant. So Abraham says to his servant, the eldest one in his house, who ruled over all that he had, we've just been told he had everything, put, I pray you, your hand under my thigh. So this is an ancient custom. We might think it's a little bit strange, but basically, put your hand, right down there. Yep. And I'm going to make you swear by Yahuwah, Elohim of heaven and the Elohim of the earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, the place where we're dwelling here, the place where I dwell. But instead, you'll go to unto my country, unto my kin, and take a wife for my son, even for Isaac. Now, another pause here. There are, there's no exact indication, although there are certainly some people that have tried to calculate about how old Isaac probably was at this point. Essentially, the consensus, I tend to think that, he's a lot older than you might think. He's certainly older than 19 or 20. He might be 37, could be as old as 40, but he's in that vicinity anyway. He's in his fourth decade of life. So he's gone for quite a while without having taken a wife. Servant says to him, well, suppose that woman won't be willing to follow me to this land. I mean, after all, that's a long ways. Must I needs bring your son back to the land from whence you came? In other words, suppose they, you know, I want to check out the goods here. Let me see the son. Nope. Abraham says to him, beware that you do not bring my son back up there. He doesn't want his son Isaac leaving the land. Yahuwah, Elohim of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my nativity, who spoke to me and he swore to me, saying, unto your seed will I give this land. He will send his Malach, his messenger, his angel before you, and you'll take a wife for my son from there. Now remember, during this process, the servant is going to swear. And he says the following, if this woman isn't willing to go after you, well, then you're clear from the oath. You've done your part. You're done. That's it. But you're still not going to bring my son back up there. So the servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, swore to him concerning this matter. And once that was done, he basically loaded up the camels and headed them on out. As a matter of fact, he loads up 10 camels, camels of his master, and departed, having all the goodly things of his masters in his hand. And he arose and he went to Aram-Naharaim, the city of Nahor. And we know who Nahor is, but we're going to get another indication in a second here. Here's the additional comment that I want to make at this point. There is quite a bit of trust involved. Think about this. Abraham has just put 10 camels and all kinds of gold and silver and gifts and other good stuff in the hand of this servant. Presumably with some men to guard it along the way and see them safely back and forth on a long and arduous journey. The servant, were he not a good and faithful servant, basically could head off into the hinterlands and probably be fixed for life. So there is a huge amount of trust here, and that's kind of the key word for the understanding of this idea of power of attorney, of delegation of authority, of agency. You don't put somebody in a position of being able to go out and to literally make a contract in your name unless you trust them. And isn't it interesting? See, we've just seen this idea of contract expressed with a detailed story, a huge amount of ink, if you will, in the Torah for land, and now something that's perhaps even more important, a wife for Isaac, and of course, through him, we know the promise is going to come. So, he heads on up north, and the camels eventually he made to kneel down outside the city by the well of water about the time in the evening when the women go out to load them up. And he spoke and he prayed, literally he said, O Yahuwah, Elohim of my master Abraham, send me, I pray you, good speed this day, show kindness to my master Abraham. So here's what he intends to do, and he outlines it in his prayer. I will stand by the fountain of water, and the daughters of the men of the city come out and draw water. So let it come to pass, he said, that the damsel to whom I say, let down your pitcher, I pray you, that I might drink, well, she will say the following to me. Yeah, you go ahead, drink, and I will give your camel something to drink too. Well, let that one be the one that you have appointed for your servant, for Isaac too, and thereby that's how I will know that you have shown kindness unto my master. So he has laid out, essentially, if you will, a test. And this is the way that he will be able to ascertain whether or not the task that he has been sent to do is being fulfilled in accord with the will of the Creator. Now, I need to mention this. We'll come back to it in just a second. Well, no, let's do it now. Okay, this is kind of funny anyway. It does appear in here in a number of places. Camels drink a lot of water, right? You know, they can go a long ways across the desert. They're kind of like the high MPG vehicle of the desert, only in this case it's MPG per gallon of water. And the way I've studied it and seen it written out, he's got 10 camels, right? And a camel probably is capable and probably in this situation would have downed about 14 gallons of water. 14 gallons of water per camel. Now, everybody know how much 14 gallons of water weighs? 8 pounds per gallon. That's a little over 110 pounds per camel. Now, how much do you think poor little Rivka weighs? I'm guessing that's about one body weight of this young woman. 100, 105, 110, even if she was 150, even if she was a really big gal, that's a lot of water and a lot of weight. She has just volunteered, basically, to move approximately 10 times her body weight, over 1,000 pounds, half a ton of water, for a perfect stranger. That's why this is an admittedly impressive test. Well, before he was even done speaking, says the scripture, here comes Rebecca. She was born to Bethuel, son of Milcah, wife of Nahor. Remember, Nahor is Abraham's brother. She had her pitcher on her shoulder. Okay, so what do you think that pitcher holds? Charitably? Probably, it's a clay pot. 4 gallons? Maybe 5 gallons? 5 gallons is 40 pounds of water? So that's close to, 3 trips or so per camel. All right, this is an impressive task. She was a very fair to look upon woman, damsel, virgin, Bethula. And it says, now this is redundant, you'd think, but it's making the point clear. Bethula, and neither had any man known her. Now, I've had people ask the question, right? What is it really to have sex? Okay, is oral sex count? One way or another, Scripture is leaving no doubt about it. She is still intact in a bodily sense, and she has not had any relationship with a man at all. Neither had any man known her, known her in an intimate sense. Period. No matter how you slice it, is the bottom line. I would read that. She went down to the fountain. She filled her pitcher. She came up. Servant ran to meet her. He said, give me to drink, I pray, a little of your water. Well, she said, go ahead, my lord, drink up. And she hastened and let down her pitcher upon her hand, and she gave him drink. And when she was done with that, she said, hey, I will draw for your camels also until they have done drinking. Now she hastened. She emptied her pitcher into the trough. She ran again to the well to draw. And drew for all his camels. So she ran again and 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 again. And probably a lot more agains. And the man looked steadfastly upon her. Yeah, picture yourself in the position of this good and faithful servant. He's watching this young woman and thinking, wow, do I serve a great and wonderful Elohim or not? He's waiting to know whether Yahuwah has made his journey prosperous, I think with increasing awe, each time she moves another bunch of gallons to the camels. So it came to pass, as the camels had finished drinking, that the man took a golden ring, half a shekel in weight. All right, this is a lot of money, even especially in current fake gold prices and dollars. 2 bracelets for her hand, 10 shekels weight of gold. We would be talking the equivalent of thousands of dollars today. And she said, whose daughter are you? I pray you, tell me. Any room in your dad's house for us to lodge? Well, she said, I'm the daughter of Bethuel, son of Milcah, whom she bore unto Nahor. And then she told him, we have both straw and provision and room to lodge. So the man bowed his head and he prostrated himself before Yahuwah. And he said what we're currently thinking and working up to. Blessed be Yahuwah, the Elohim of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his mercy and his truth toward my master. As for me, Yahuwah has led me to the very house of my master's brethren. What are the odds, right? Well, they're 100% if you're serving the right God. The damsel ran. She told her mother's house, according to these words. Rivka, by the way, had her brother. Now, we're going to learn this name and see this fellow again. His name was Laban. Laban ran out to the man, to the fountain. It came to pass. He saw the ring. He saw the bracelets. Okay. I'm guessing his eyes got kind of big. We're going to learn a lot about Laban and his proclivities. But it seems like when he saw the gold on his sister's hands and wrists, well, he got the message. So he heard the words of Rivka's sister, saying, this is what the man said unto me. And he came to him. Behold, he was there by the camels at the fountain. And he said, come on in, you blessed of Yahuwah. Why are you standing outside? I've cleared the house, made room for the camels. You betcha. So the man came into the house. He ungirded the camels, gave straw and provision for the camels, water to wash the feet and the feet of the men that were with him. And there was set food before the servant to eat. But he said, look, I am not going to eat until I have explained to you all my errand. Well, speak on, he was told. And then he went and said the following. And you got to figure that there is some amazement in them as well. "I am Abraham's servant," he says, "and Yahuwah has greatly blessed my master. He has become great. He's got flocks and herds, silver and gold, men servants and maidservants, camels and asses, you name it. And Sarah, my master's wife, and I suspect they know both of these names, bore a son to my master when she was old. And unto that man, that son, he has given all that he has. And my master made me swear the following. He said, 'You're not to take a wife for my son from the daughters of Canaan, where we dwell, but instead you're to go to my father's house, to my kin, and take a wife for my son.' And I told my master, 'I suppose a woman won't come with me.' And he said, 'Yahuwah, before whom I walk, will send his Malach with you. He'll prosper your way, and you'll take a wife for my son of my kin and of my father's house. And if you do that, you'll be clear from my oath when you come to my kin. And if they don't give her to you or won't, well, then you're also clear from the oath. And I came this day unto the fountain, and I said, 'O Yahuwah, Elohim of my master Abraham, if I'm now prospering in the way that I go, behold, here I am standing by this fountain. Let it come to pass that some maiden will come forth, draw water, and I'll ask her for a drink. And she will say the following to me, "You drink, and your camels too, and I'll draw water for all your camels." Well, he said, "I pray that that would be the same woman whom Yahuwah has appointed for my master's son. And look, before I was even done speaking to my heart, here comes Rivka, with her pitcher on her shoulder. She went down the fountain, she drew, and I said, 'Let me drink, I pray you.' She made haste, she drew from her pitcher, she said, 'Drink, hey, and your camels too. I'll give them all the water they need.' So I drank, and she made the camels drink also." Now, I don't know, honestly. This is the place where you read the story and you think, these folks here are listening to the story. Laban's probably thinking, "Well, that's my sister. Yeah, that's Rivka. She does this all the time." Right? I'm guessing not. Now, I am guessing that probably he thinks, yeah, that would be the kind of thing Rivka might do under the right circumstances, or maybe not. But I guarantee you, he's also thinking, 10 camels? Over 1,000 pounds, or whatever the current equivalent would be? Wow, that's a lot of water. Well, I asked her, "Whose daughter are you?" She told me, "Son of Bethuel, Nahor's, a daughter of Bethuel, Nahor's son." And I put this ring upon her nose and the bracelets on her hand, and I bowed my head, and I gave thanks, prostrated myself before Yahuwah, and blessed him, Elohim of my master Abraham. He led me right here. And now, if you all will deal kindly and truly with my master, tell me. And if not, well, tell me that too, so that I can turn either to the right hand or to the left." Well, Laban and Bethuel answered, and they said, "This thing obviously comes from Yahuwah. We can't speak unto you either good or bad. But behold, hey, here's Rivka right in front of you. Take her and go. Let her be your master's son's wife, as Yahuwah has spoken." Now, we're going to see, of course, that one of the other elements to this contract, her father has passed, but Laban, in this sense, her brother, is evidently acting in her father's stead as the one who is going to, if you will, who gives this woman. But she still has a choice. We're going to see here in just a second how she implements that choice as well, because this is a voluntary contract. So it comes to pass, when Abraham's servant heard their words, he bowed himself down to Yahuwah, bowed himself down to the earth. And then the servant brought forth all kinds of good stuff, jewels, silver, jewels of gold, raiment, clothing. In other words, gave them to Rivka. He gave good stuff, precious things, also to her brother and her mother. They all eat and drank, the men that were with him. They tarried all night long. When they got up in the morning, he said, "All right, it's time to head him out. Send me away to my master." Well, not so fast. Her brother and her mother said, "Well, let the damsel abide with us a few more days. At least 10. And then, after that, she can go." And I suspect he senses that there is a problem here. Obviously, he's anxious to get back home, too, because it's a long trip. But every delay would seem to be an additional issue. So he says to them, "Delay me not, seeing Yahuwah has prospered my way. Send me away so I can get on back to my master." Well, here's what. We will call on Rivka. We'll call the damsel, and we'll see what she has to say. So they call Rivka, and he said unto her, "Will you go with this man?" And she said, "I will go." Evidently, that means I'll go right now. He wants to go now. I'm ready to go. So they sent away Rivka and their sister and her nurse and Abraham's servant and his men. And they blessed Rivka, and they said to her, "Our sister, be you the mother of thousands of 10,000s, and let your seed possess the gate of those who hate them. Now, here's where I'm going to pause. Verse 60 of chapter, what is this? Chapter 24 of the book of Bereshit. Because we've just talked about offer and acceptance as being elements of contract. Certainly, we not only have offer and acceptance in this case, but a covenant of marriage, which is, I guess you could think of it in a way, I've heard it explained this way, as interlocking covenants. The husband makes a covenant to his wife, the wife makes a covenant, the wife and the husband-to-be make covenants to one another. In this case, of course, interestingly, the husband isn't there. And this is being done by proxy, again, by power of attorney, by agency, delegation of authority. It's the father, Abraham, who has sent out a man to bring home a wife for his son. But it's Rebecca, that has the veto power. She has already agreed to do this, and the way I like to explain it is the following. It's one thing to say that I will be this person's wife. At the moment when that offer and acceptance is given, in other words, will you be the wife? Here's the offer to come and be a wife. She says yes. At that point, she is betrothed. Nowadays, we would say engaged, but the scripture also points out that while she is not yet consummated, the deal has not yet been sealed, and they have not yet become one flesh, she is still, at that instant, a wife. For someone else to violate her is an act of adultery. And the way I like to put it, though, is that really, if you want to think about the thing where the covenant is clear, because up until this point, based on the servant's apprehension, he still is, kind of anxious to get on the road. At the point where Rivka gets on the camel, if you will, and heads out, leaves her home behind, she's committed. And that's a that's an incredible thing, a wonderful thing. So, Rivka arose, her damsels, she takes her own crew with her. They rode upon the camels, they followed the man, and the servant took Rivka, and he went his way. Now, several days later, obviously, this is a long trip, here we find Isaac. He's coming out by Be'er Lahai Roy, for he dwelt in the land of the south. And he goes out about evening time to meditate in the field, to pray. He lifts up his eyes, and look, here's a caravan of camels coming. Now, Rivka, too, from the camel, she lifts up her eyes. She sees Isaac there in the distance, and eventually she gets closer. She comes off the camel. And at that point, she says to the servant, "Who is this? What man is this that walks in the field to meet us?" And the servant said, "It is my master." Now, he has two masters. Obviously, he has the father master, Abraham, and in this case, he's referring to the man who will inherit the son, Isaac, also as his master. So she took her veil, she covered herself. Now, the servant at this point relates the whole story to Isaac, all the things that he has done. I suspect at this point Isaac is pretty excited. He's checking out the caravan. And which one is it? Oh, yeah, it's her. That one, the one with the veil. We don't see a whole lot of conversation. We don't see much else. What we do see here, I will contend, in the last line of chapter 24 is a very succinct summary of the first complete marriage covenant that we see outlined in Scripture. Now, we know that there have been other people, Adam and Chava. That was kind of a special case, right? She was created exclusively from Adam, for Adam. But on the other hand, we've seen lots of other people that have been married and have begotten children, including Abraham and Sarah. But this is the first time we see the entire process outlined. And here's the summary in one verse. Last verse of chapter 24, verse 67. And I will contend that when it comes to the question, what constitutes marriage? Well, we understand the contract elements, offer and acceptance. And then we have this. And Yitzhak brought her, Rivka, into his mother Sarah's tent. Takes her inside. He took her, that root word, lachach. He literally consummated the marriage. He took her, and she became his wife. And he loved her. Now, what is really cool about this, I think, is the very interesting order. Doesn't say he loved her, he dated her for a long time. Doesn't say that he met the family. Doesn't say anything of that. Doesn't say he went down and got a piece of paper from some black-robed priest of another god that certifies the marriage, licenses the marriage, doesn't have a blood, none of that jazz. He took her into his tent, he took her, and there you go. She was his Isha. At that instant, she was his Isha for real, consummated. Now, she was literally his betrothed, his Isha, from the moment she got on the camel before he even knew about it. But the consummation here is described in specific detail. And then you get this, and I've always thought this was amazing. It's so contrary to the way we're told it's supposed to be done. And he loved her. And he loved her. Do you get the impression maybe they're talking about a different kind of love than just, I saw her on the street corner, I saw her standing there, had a dance, we went home and did the deed, and I loved her, and then I'll love a bunch of others. And if I fall out of love, hey, what the heck, no harm, no foul. He took her, she became his wife, and he loved her. And then it says, and Isaac was comforted for his mother. So now we've seen probably two of the most important elements of law in so many areas. Common law, land contract, the importance of real money, kesef, and offer and acceptance and compensation in the real sense. Then we saw this idea of covenant and what it means in terms of power of attorney, what it means to come in the name of his master Abraham, delegation of authority, legal authority to implement a contract in the name of the father for the son. The whole point of trust, of course. And now the consummation and the idea of what it really means to understand marriage itself. Chapter 25. Nice, interesting, continuing segue. Abraham, it says, took another wife. Ve'yechak. Same word. It took a wife. Her name, in this case, was Keturah. Now, I don't usually emphasize a lot about the Midrash. I find it kind of interesting that there's a whole lot of people, speculation, could this be Hagar by another name? Certainly can't prove it either way. It does seem a little bit dubious, but you'll nevertheless see those that'll teach it. Honestly, I don't know. I don't think it matters. What matters is, here is this fairly old dude. Sarah passed at 127 years. We know Abraham is older than her by a decade or so. And yet, this old man is going to be pretty prolific. Keturah bore him Zimron and Yokshan and Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shua. And we're going to see more of the line. Jokshan has sons too, Sheba and Dedan, sons of Dedan, Asherim, Letushim, and Leumim. Sons of Midian, Ephah, Epher, Hanok, Abidah, Eldaah, all of these were the children of Keturah. So we've got children and grandchildren. And Abraham, though, gives all that he had unto Isaac. Now, Abraham, as we know, has one older son, Ishmael, and we know that he is going to be a prince. But we know that Isaac is the son of prophet, of promise, and that it says here he inherits coal. But he also, Abraham, that is, had other concubines. And the sons of the concubines that Abraham had, he gave gifts to them too. And he sent them away from Isaac while he lived eastward into the east country. And now we're going to come to the story of the end of Abraham's life. He lived 115 years, so 175 years. Another four decades or so after he lost his wife Sarah. And during that time, he has an entire additional set of progeny and grandchildren. And he expired and died in a good old age, an old man full of years, and he was gathered to his people. And Isaac and Ishmael, his sons, buried him in the place that we've just seen described, Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, of Zohar the Hittite, son of Zohar the Hittite, before Mamre. That field that Abraham purchased from the children of Heth, that's where Abraham was buried, along with Sarah, his wife. And then we come to the last verse of the Parsha. came to pass after the death of Abraham that Elohim blessed Isaac his son. And Isaac dwelt in a place called Be'er Lahai Roi, which is essentially that same well, if you remember Hagar's well, the well of the living vision.